The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 195. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, make sure you take a moment to leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. It helps us go up in the rankings, helps us reach more people and spread this message all over the world. And it only takes like 10 to 15 seconds. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, send me an email. My email is in the show notes and I'll reply back and send you a free training on how to find and evaluate properties. So if you're somebody who doesn't know how to really look for properties, doesn't really know how to run the numbers and make sure it's profitable and all those things, this is definitely a training you want to check out. It's about 30 minutes and it's been updated to reflect the high interest rates that we have today. So I definitely look forward to hearing from you. Super excited about this episode with Michael Meredith. We shot it live in New Orleans and he's doing some amazing things, including building 900 units for a project called the River District Project out in New Orleans. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video. Make sure you share, subscribe. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. Live from New Orleans with Michael Meredith. Michael, appreciate you jumping on the show, man. How you doing today?
I'm good, man. Happy to be here. Happy to be having a conversation, man, and excited to see where it goes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first, just want to congratulate you on being part of the River District project. I know you mentioned being the master developer. Your company's building, I believe, 900 units there. And you also mentioned y'all own 500 units already and so much more that we'll get into. So just want to say congrats on that.
I appreciate it, man. Yeah, it's a journey, obviously. We're just having that conversation before here, 13 years in New Orleans, and excited about where we're at and definitely where we're headed as well, too.
Definitely, definitely. So, man, let's jump into the River District project. We'd love if you could let the people know just an overview of like what the project is, what it's going to bring to the city, and just a bit more about what VPG will be doing as part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it has its genesis, you know, close to 4 or 5 years ago, you know, as a convention center thought about how it repurposes, you know, 37 plus acres of land next to the Morial Convention Center there at the riverfront. And so we assembled what we think is an all-star team of local developers to go after this and respond to the RFP. And we were selected as a master developer, which basically gave us the rights to, you know, to develop the horizontal pieces, but as well as, you know, the vertical pieces that come out of the ground. And for me, you know, I look back at our history here in Louisiana and maybe a little biased, but I think it's probably one of the biggest economic development projects that, you know, our city has seen in its history. You know, it'll be $1 billion plus development when it's all said and done, really centered around entertainment, housing, office, retail, and still things yet to be determined, right? This is going to be multi-phase, you know, multi-year type of development. We really looked at the Wharf in Washington, D.C. as a great example of what can be done when you tie in water, entertainment, housing, all those things. And we've been able to put some, I think, some good wins on the board so far. We've got Topgolf. It's going to be breaking ground. In December. And we've got Shell Oil, you know, moving their headquarters, their Gulf of Mexico's headquarters there as well, too. So, you know, these are I think, you know, good dominoes to fall. And I think we've got some more exciting things to come there as well, too.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is when people think about development, a lot of times they just see that big building going up, mm-hmm. but they don't think about the tax revenue it'll bring to the city. They don't think about the jobs that it'll bring to the city and just like the quality of life that will be improved for everybody in the city and in the surrounding areas. So can you shed a bit of light on that aspect of it too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously you see the big, pretty, you know, buildings, but, you know, there's got to be people that are in there. And one thing that I'm proud to say is that, you know, we talk about housing, you know, half of the units that we're building there will be for affordable and workforce housing, right? So those are folks who can live and work in the same place, right? And have access to transportation. But, you know, that's an awesome thing to say that a person who is living in affordable housing can live next to a Topgolf or live next to a Fortune 500 company that's bringing their headquarters or have access to fresh foods and high-class retail and, you know, cheap transportation, right? Which yeah. is a, you know, becomes a barrier in a lot of our metros. So, you know, you think about, you know, those things, but you know, you give access for folks to have quality of life, but also to have fun, right? Yeah. Because ultimately that's what we work hard for, is to be able to enjoy that and enjoy that in a way that is attainable, affordable, but also right in your backyard too.
Definitely. So you mentioned about 50% will be workforce or affordable housing, right?
Yes.
So I think that's pretty astounding. So it's interesting. One of the questions I hear from people sometimes is they don't think that affordable housing is profitable. Mm-hmm. So can you just share some more about the reality of what that looks like from a high level perspective and you know, what somebody should be considering?
Yeah, I mean, it is a niche, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you do it right, you know, it is a different model, right? You know, as an affordable housing developer, you're very fee heavy, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're funding deals through low-income housing tax credits, you know, the structure is as such where you're going to, you know, be paid a sizable fee up front. Mm-hmm. And cash flow is going to be limited, you know, during that affordability period. But in the end, the money just comes in at different times, right? And so it can be profitable if it's done the right way. And, you know, you have to be able to bring all the parties to the table, right? Because you've got low-income tax credits. Sometimes you're going to be stacking that with CDBG funds and funds from the city and infrastructure dollars. So typically that capital stack looks a lot different. But the profitability is driven about how you're able to fill those gaps in a way that makes sense, limiting your debt service and create as much cash flow as you can.
Definitely. So you already started on the next question. Yeah. So one of the things I was going to ask, if you could expand a bit on low income tax credits. Mm-hmm. And I think the next was CDBG. If you could expand on those a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, low income tax credits is a program I think was created in the late 80s, which basically helped to incentivize developers to, you know, to do affordable projects. Right. And so there's federal tax credits that they can be sold to tax credits investors and invested back into the project, which, you know, gives you, you know, I want to say free equity, but it in its essence, it is dollars that don't have to be paid back, assuming that you, you know, do and keep the affordability over that time period. So it basically reduces your basis in the deal. Mm-hmm. That way you can charge rents that are less than, let's say, you know, the market value. There's two types of credit. There's a 4% credit, which gives you somewhere around 30 to 35% of your project costs. And then that's a non-competitive credit. And there's a 9% credit, which is very competitive, which can pay somewhere between 70 to 80% of your costs. And, you know, from there, you know, you've got that part of your stack, and you may need other gap funds as well, too. So we talked about CDBG, Community Development Block Grant Funds. Those are federal dollars that come into state and local agencies that they can then provide additional, you know, subsidies for affordable housing developers. Because eventually you're just trying to make sure that you can cover your debt service, right? Right, and you need some help, right? You need some subsidies to be able to make that happen. So those are just two of the sources that we use to help do that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate you mentioning that because all over the internet, the rhetoric right now is nothing is affordable. Mm-hmm. Like people can't afford to live where they work. Mm-hmm. People have to move far out and commute in. And I appreciate you breaking those down because I think the disconnect that a lot of people have, like just average people, right? Mm-hmm. They're not developers, but they just see all these things happening, is the fact that you need that funding for it to make sense. Because
absolutely,
you still have to put food on the table.
Yeah,
You still got to, you know, your employees still have to eat. Yeah. Like, people still have to make money. So I like that, because now people have the explanation and understand all of what goes into it. And in the absence of that, it's pretty hard to make a deal make sense.
Yeah. I mean, as a developer, this is our job, right? And, you know, we're going to be trying to create cash flow, create value. And, you know, we're not a nonprofit. You know, right. Even nonprofits are making sure that their deals make sense, right? Because the last thing they want to do is, you know, they've still got to bring debt on the property. So they got to be able to service the debt. And to your point too, you know, affordability is a wide range of words, from market to people. You know, most people think about affordable housing. They think about folks technically, which are 80% or below the average median income. So, but there's no subsidy. There's not a lot of subsidy for folks, let's say, who are between 80% and 120%. Those are your engineers or your nurses and folks who still may need help or some subsidy, you know, to be able to afford to live in a safe place. And we're starting to see some dollars, you know, we call it the missing middle, right?
Yeah.
Folks don't necessarily talk about the folks who are not in the technically affordable and you know, not in the wealthy, where they don't necessarily have to worry about rent. And we're starting to see folks and funding come out to address that, but that is a large gap, and typically folks call it workforce housing. But there's not a lot of federal dollars out there currently for that.
Yeah. It's so funny. I had a guy on a couple months ago who said the same exact thing. Like, the folks in the middle, because, you know, if you're on the very, very bottom, right, and that's just your situation, it's actually a lot of programs. And there's like, it's not the best situation to be in. However, there's a lot of resources for you.
Right.
If you're at the top, whatever, you don't need anybody. But it's like the middle class, you know, the average worker. Who, I mean, you said it best, missing middle, because it's like, what about us? That's the rhetoric out right now, right?
So, but I even want to go deeper. Think about this, right? So think about somebody who wants to transition from this side, right, the affordable side, to the middle, right? Let's say they're at 75% AMI, and they want to say, I got a promotion at my job that may get me to 85% AMI.
Yeah,
they may wipe out their entire, you know, promotion, not having to pay for housing. It may have been a better state for them, somebody to pay all of their housing at 75% AMI, than it would be for them to have to pay all of their housing at 85% AMI. So we have tenants, and we've gone through this situation where folks are like, you know, I got a Section 8 voucher right now, but I don't want to take this promotion, because if I do, they're going to take away my housing dollars. And so I think that's a policy thing that we need to think about and talk about. You know, address, because there's a limiting factor on movement and folks' careers and jobs, because these folks are thinking about how this affects, you know, their net, you know, of their personal income.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a challenge I have with it, is because it incentivizes, I mean, you make your own choices, but I could understand someone staying there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're scared. Maybe they're afraid of like that responsibility or what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there needs to be some change in policy that incentivizes folks to. I mean, some folks are just going to do it, right?
But
incentivize as many people as possible to make it to that next level. Because I mean, that should be the goal.
Absolutely.
It limits to stay there with like the voucher or whatever it is. It limits, assuming you're healthy and all that stuff. It limits the trajectory of you and your family, and it's a ripple effect.
Yep.
And you know, we know all the stories. Like, sometimes it becomes a perpetual
cycle,
generation to generation. So I'm with you on that.
Yeah. I didn't mean to go too deep on you.
No, that's what we're here for.
Yeah,
that's what we're here for, man.
For sure.
Yeah, I have conversations like that all the time with my friends and family. And I just wish that those kind of programs were paired with programs that help people. And maybe there is something that exists like that, but in my opinion, the ideal situation is if somebody is like on a voucher or some sort of program that, all right, there's a timeline.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, here are the resources. You need to, if you want to stay on this, you need to go through these, and will help you get mm-hmm. to the next level. And then you bring in the next person who is going through that situation for a period of time, and everyone moves up. I think that would be the perfect situation, but maybe the powers that be. I don't know. I'm being a conspiracy theorist now, but that's my take.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Definitely, man. So one of the conversations we had last week, you mentioned that, you know, everything started with a 4-unit building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now y'all are about to build 900 plus units. You have a vertically integrated company, 500 units that y'all own right now, but it started with 4 units. And mm-hmm. I think it's important for people to understand that, because there's a start everywhere, right?
Yep.
You know, people might see the 12, 13 years you're in now, but talk about the beginning. Talk about the beginning and getting started.
Yeah, so we bought our first deal off Craigslist. it was a fourplex, and, you know, we went through, you know, pretty much every guru's class and, you know, weekend course you could, and we decided, man, we're just going to take action. And we bought this this 4-unit building, and we were just so excited, you know. Like, it was just me and Dre, and we were just rolling. And, you know, we bought the property, and a month later, 3 of the tenants moved out, right? Oh, and so now we got to figure out how to become property managers and maintenance guys. And so many stories of refrigerators falling off trucks and you know, almost burning the house down, changing out ceiling fans and doing our own landscaping. But, like, that really helped us to understand, like, the mechanics of what it takes to run a property, and a little bit of empathy of kind of that hand-to-hand between us and the tenants, right? Mm-hmm. And so as you go from 4 to 8 to 16 to 32 to 100 to 175, 200, 400, 500, right? There's like this snowball effect. Along the way, you kind of learn the true mechanics of how to operate a property, because that's much different from a desk than it is in a property manager seat or maintenance guys, and the little nuances, you know, that come around there. So I think, you know, we really took the approach to kind of have that personal hand in hand. We had no choice. We didn't have any money, right? But I think it we didn't create a barrier to entry, right? We decided we were going to take the properties that nobody wanted, that we saw value in, that we could put our sweat equity into to create value. And then, just like Monopoly, you trade up, right? You know, in order to get the hotel, you got to have 4 small houses or whatever the rule is, right? Yeah. And so I think that was really the approach that we took. And it takes time, right? You know, there's an inflection point at some point where you start to move from family and friends to local bank to institutional capital. But that takes proving yourself at every single one of those levels. Yeah. I think we took that path, and it's really served us well, too, in times where things get tighter, right? When interest rates get higher, insurance rates get higher, how do you really pull the most out of your property, right? And I think that knowledge that we gained along the way, you know, has truly, truly helped.
Definitely. There's one thing you mentioned I want to go back to. You mm-hmm. said you looked for the properties that no one else wanted.
Yeah.
And I think that's something people need to really think about, because a lot of times, you know, we see, you know, what's on HGTV or whatever, on the internet or whatever the case is. But I think there's something to be said for having that vision of what something could be, and looking at, you know, what people have tossed aside. Because mm-hmm. in my opinion, in many cases, I'm sure you've experienced this, that's where the greatest upside is.
Yeah, I mean, I can guarantee you, like, we still have some of those legacy properties in our portfolio, but none of them are the sexy deals you go see on HGTV, right? Yeah. You go to ride past them and, you know, they just another house or another fourplex or another, you know, double on the street. But that's how we were able to create kind of that critical mass of portfolio, was through these owner finance, bond for deed, subject to type of deals mm-hmm. where owners were tired and didn't want to be landlords and we'll step in, right? And we had enough, either, you know, being as naive as we were, or just, you know, gusto to just say, hey, look, you know, we're going to go in and create value. And it paid off for us, right? And, but that was not without some foresight to understand that we're not going to have access to premier deals right now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we build our experience and build our capital up, we'll start to be able to access some of these deals in that sense, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I think, you know, that's a testament to just starting where you are with mm-hmm. what you have and just getting better from there.
Yeah.
You know, and not looking for, like, the perfect situation, but looking for the opportunity.
Yeah.
So I think that's big. You mentioned tired landlords. So I've been reading different articles, and a lot of folks going to be retiring mm-hmm. over the next several years or so, 5-10 years. Tired landlords. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of those coming mm-hmm. down the pipeline. What tips do you have for someone out there who is looking for those tired landlords and opportunities to help them unload some of their properties?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, we were in a different, little bit different era before social yeah. media just kind of blew up, right? Yeah. And so we never took like one strategy, right? Yeah. We understood that there was the strategy about me to be getting out, shaking hands, meeting folks and all of the real estate clubs that we could. Mm-hmm. But we also went old school with the mail campaign, right? Yeah. And so I'm an engineer by trade. And so we're thinking about data is, you know, we went to the tax assessor site and we said, okay, we want to scrub all of the landlords who got properties in a personal name, right? Because that lets me know that they're probably not that sophisticated to have an apartment complex in their personal name. And two is that's typically like your mom and pop, right? Either properties that have been passed down. And so we targeted those folks with a mail campaign, and we probably bought 300, 400 units just off of that, right? Like wow. folks who we sent letters to 6 times and finally gave us a call back and told us no 7 times and said yes on the 8th, right?
Yeah.
But those deals didn't have a realtor involved. Those deals were relationship driven, and so yeah. price wasn't as big of a deal. And so sometimes you got to get a little old school to tax those folks who are still in that generation, right? Yeah. They may not respond to an Instagram DM, but they'll open a letter in their mailbox, right? And yeah. those are the legacy folks that I think, you know, like you said, are going to be retiring. It's something that we, you know, we still do.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, man, because there's so many different tools out there that you could use to reach out to people and all this stuff. But, you know, sometimes, you know, doing things like just sending a letter works. And I like that you connected it to the generation too.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, we're more savvy with technology and stuff like that, but somebody with a bunch of properties who's had them for 30, 40 years
yeah.
might just be opening their mail. And that's how they correspond with people.
You got to get, Dre's not here, he's my business partner, but he always says, man, you got to get in the streets. You know, sometimes you need to drive the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, we've got deals where we roll up on the maintenance guy, right? You see the maintenance guy out there cutting grass and you say, you know, hey man, you know, do you know the owner? You mind putting me in touch with the owner? And 9 times out of 10, they got him on the cell phone. It's like, hey, here's your yeah. number right here. That's the, you know, that kind of introduction and that relationship building that is, I would say, unconventional in a yeah. digital world is, you know, these folks that have owned these properties in legacy, they've got a little different way of communicating. We got to make sure that we meet them there.
Definitely. I love that. So, hey, if you're watching, make sure you know how to communicate with different kind of people, different kind of sellers, and you know, hopefully you can get some more deals and say that you learned it here. So you started with the 4 units. How did you guys scale?
Mm-hmm.
And as you scaled, what kind of financing, what did you have to change to take on some of those bigger deals?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I would say we had the luxury, but we did the building blocks. So at every level, you know, we had to scale up, right? But I would say one thing is we never treated it like a hustle. You know, it was always a business. So if it was two of us, we had weekly standing meetings, right? And yeah. we had metrics and all of those things when we had 8 units, right? Yeah. And so we you know, built and scaled those processes and those systems along the way to meet, you know, where we were. And, you know, that came with also hiring new folks, right? Yeah. So, you know, it was just two of us for probably the first 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then we hired a property manager. So that gave us some time to really address and dive deep and work on the business. And then we just continued to hire folks. And then we looked at how do we be competitive in our market? Mm-hmm. And we decided we wanted to vertically integrate. So that means, you know, formalizing our property management company with systems and employees, formalizing our construction company with experienced employees, and having all those verticals work as one to be able to take on more institutional type of deals, right? And so they helped us graduate from capital when it was, you know, friends from college at 50% interest, right? You had to convince your homeboy to give you, you know, some some money for a down payment. You have 50% interest. You know, he can't say no to that. To syndicating, larger sums of money amongst high net worth investors and local regional banks, to more recently our relationship with Goldman Sachs and Urban Investment Group to our debt facility. So, it is a learning curve that goes along the way, but it's, I look back at it and look at it as a blessing that I didn't have to go from A to Z, right? Yeah. Because that is a huge learning curve to say I don't have any experience to now. Yeah. I want to be starting to talk to institutional investors. There is a piece in the middle that needs to be nurtured, that needs to be, maturated for it to, to really make sense.
Definitely. And I really like that you mentioned just going step by step, and that, you had systems for 8 units and then you got them down and you kept those and you used those as you scaled up. And I think a lot of times, I'm probably guilty of this too, like when you have a little bit of something or you have maybe one or two properties, you're kind of loosey-goosey with it. But, then how are you getting ready for when you have more?
Right.
How are you preparing for when you have more? So I like that you mentioned that. And then also, everybody wants to get to the top. So everybody wants to get to where you're at in a year, right? But to your point, there's that piece in the middle.
Like
you have to go through that process to really be able to take advantage when you do get to that step. And, sometimes it could take, you gotta have some staying power.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been in this for over 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great to have vision, right? Yeah. Even when we had 0 properties, we always talked about having a $1 billion company, right? And that's still the vision. But in order to get to a $1 billion company, you got to take some action. So if I'm waiting 20 years for a $1 billion deal, I may never get there. But if I say, hey, I'm going to take step one on this $150,000 deal, then, that is a step towards whatever that goal is, and not to let, non-sexy opportunities, get past you, or opportunities that necessarily don't look like a shiny ruby or a diamond, not get into your pipeline.
Definitely. So talk to us a bit about the vertical integration. I think that's really key, and I'm sure it helps tremendously in the business. So can you break that down a little bit and just explain how you guys have it set up, and also, why it's been advantageous for you over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, I wouldn't say it was this, great idea. Some of it came out of necessity, right? It's like you get into these deals and you get a bad property manager, like, all right, let's start a property management group ourselves, right? And you get into a deal and you get a bad contractor and you're like, all right, let's do this ourselves. And I think once we kind of had that rolling in a somewhat, I would say rhythm, we really thought about how we formalize that. Mm-hmm. And when we formalized that, we saw that we could plug those segments in whenever we wanted to, right? And so we, on a deal, we're not always all three. Sometimes we are. And, more recently, in a strategic, partnership, we brought another one of my line brothers on to run our construction company. Now that company does more work for other folks than it does for us. So it kind of has offshot into its own particular lane. But, typically, if you're only a developer, you've got to get management input on a deal, right? So I now got to go out to a third party and take time, is that trusted, advice or information? Or now I've got to go to a contractor to get rough pricing and to get, estimates and knowledge into a deal. And that takes time and trust, right? Mm-hmm. Now, by us having in-house, we're a little bit more nimble, right? I can just walk down to next door office and talk to our senior property manager and answer this question and see how this rolls into a deal. Walk down the hall, talk to our construction estimators and get a little bit of input of what's going on. And so, those verticals do, have their own profit centers, but a lot of times it's just having that in-house under the roof knowledge on how to underwrite a deal and how to move a deal forward and some of the nuances that go along.
Yeah, I love that. I love that it's beneficial internally, but also you're able to take on other clients.
Yep.
What was the hardest part for you to in hiring people and finding the right people to fill these different areas?
Still is hard, man. Yeah. I mean, I think, being a young African-American in business is in itself very difficult, right? And in some of our industries, if you look at, you know, just purely where the demographics of the most experienced folks are, they don't look like us, right? So you can think about what it's like to have somebody who has 20 years of experience having to come and work for a young Black guy, right? In a company that is, you know, unapologetic about, you know, where the company started and who, you know, the ownership, you know, lies with. So I think, you know, some of those hurdles come into play, right? Just some of those cultural and, you know, things that have been systematic over the years. But I think it's also in a, such a competitive environment, right? As construction costs and salaries are constantly going up, is attracting the right folks that want to come and work for, you know, a growing mid-sized construction company or growing mid-sized developer. That is a different level of attraction than going to work for, you know, the big, you know, 100-year construction company, right? And so how we try to combat that is just being pure to our culture, which has nothing to do with our race, right? That's just, we want to be a company that's about passion, resourcefulness, integrity, dependability, and excellence, right? And people who want to tie into that to work on cool projects and have fun, right? Yeah. And so if you see our social media, you know, we do pranks around the office and, you know, we got TikTok videos because that's like, that's who we want people to come and be who they are at VPG and not have to put on anything different. So that's, I would say, the hard part is attracting talent. But I think the converse of that is trying to create a culture that does that. And that's a daily struggle.
Definitely. So when did y'all transition to like the development side?
You know, I think that really came in our foray into 3700 Bienville. You know, previous to that, we had everything was was rehab, right? And this townhome development, was 20 units in kind of mid city here in New Orleans. That was a ground up construction, and so that really, I think, put us into a realm where we had to take a plot of land, create a vision. Create a development plan and who we're going to bring in, who's our demographics, construct it and then exit, right? And that's, that would say back in 2017 was the genesis of that. And then 2019 was our selling of that asset.
Got it. What was that? What did you learn from that experience, that first development?
Oh, man.
We'll be here all day, huh?
There was so many lessons learned because, you know, transparently, that wasn't a great project for us, right? You know, we probably did everything wrong you could on a development. But, you know, making sure that our budgets were intact on the construction side. We were both the developer and the GC. That's a very tough thing to do on a ground up development because there's no finger to point. I'm always pointing back at myself. Yeah. And then just making sure that your contracts are tight, right, with whoever you're in partnership with. All of those were learning lessons and how, you know, make sure you had the right legal team was in space. And you know, we definitely took a hit on that project. It wasn't as successful, but the lessons that we learned truly have come exponentially, right? Yeah. And we've avoided those mistakes in our other development projects.
It makes a lot of sense. Something I had a question about and something people have asked about is, how do you know what is the right exit strategy for development? So how do you know whether you keep it for a period of time then sell it, or sell it ASAP, or hold long term? How do you guys typically determine what to do?
I mean, I think you always have a plan A, B, and C, right? And the numbers of where you are in the market now kind of dictate, all right, you know, where do I see the market going down, right? So is this value going to, you know, the potential value of this decrease with what I see coming in the market conditions where I want to exit now? Is it predictable cash flow, right? Is this, and is this predictable cash flow giving me the returns that I want to see on, you know, the equity that's in the deal? And then, you know, truthfully, you know, when you're a developer, you're raising capital, right? So you've got debt and you've got, you know, some type of equity investors. A lot of times that equity, that strategy is based on how your equity is set up. Are these long-term folks? So they want to be in a deal 10, 15 years, or are they more short-term and want to churn? And so you got to figure out how to either sell or refinance, or if we can just cash flow this thing for the next 10, 15 years and bank on total appreciation, right? So a lot of those things really go into that. And, you know, I would say I'm probably 50-50 on exit strategy where it starts up to where it ends. But I think that's the great thing about real estate. There's multiple, you know, profit centers where, hey, I may not have cash flowed this deal great for 5 years, but it appreciated in this market to where I'm able to recapture even more proceeds than I would have thought of, you know, if I would have, you know, just sold it in the very beginning.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. So we spoke about challenges with hiring talent. What have been some of the challenges of being a Black developer? Because there's, you know the numbers. It's not that many Black developers compared to other folks. So what's that been like for you?
That's a good one. I mean, I think, you know, there is unfortunately a stigma of where there's not an automatic sense of capability and capacity when you come into a room or to a meeting, right? And so, you know, there is this constant urge of having to validate capacity, experience, and all those things before you can even have a conversation, right? So that's one thing. I think, you know, access to capital has always been, you know, tough, right? Because it comes with relationships, and those relationships just systematically, historically haven't been established between folks that look like me and institutional investors, right? And there's been a gap there. And I think, you know, also too is, you know, just the inherent transfer of real estate is sometimes relational too. Right. The best deals are not the ones that hit the MLS. The best deals are the, you know, the networking, you know, I don't even say off market, but just relational things that come. And so when you're not in that network, you don't get that access to the net worth either. And so those have been some hurdles. You know, we've definitely done some things to help, you know, get over that. But, you know, there's been times where, you know, I've been at the property and, you know, people walk by and, you know, walk by me and go to the contractor and have, ask a question to him like he's the owner, right? And those things hurt emotionally, right? You got to kind of peel yourself back. And those things are, like I said, they're not things that just go away, and things that we got to fight, you know, fight against on a daily basis.
Yep. I appreciate your transparency on that. Makes a lot of sense. What are some reasons that you, how can we get more Black developers, more Black folks in construction, more Black folks leading property management companies? What are some things that come to mind for you?
I mean, I think one is we got to be doing a better job of promoting folks that look like me and other Black developers to see that it's possible, right? Because, you know, there's only a handful of folks that I could have pointed to before I got into this. I say, okay, they look like me, they've been successful. And sometimes that's 90% of the thing is, okay, this is actually an attainable goal. And so making sure that we get exposure and platforms like you're providing are awesome, you know, pieces of that. And then the other part is education. It started this in our colleges, our universities, and our high schools, you know, post that for folks to start, you know, getting immersed into the environment, but understanding the dynamics of how real estate works. That doesn't even have to be from, you know, this big commercial experience, right? It's just, man, figuring out how to buy your first house. Most folks can graduate college, but don't understand the mechanics of what it takes to go and buy their first home. And, you know, you use those same mechanics to grow and you get the basics and build those up to bigger deals. But we need to be pouring in and making that a part of, you know, our curriculums and extracurricular activities to make sure that those folks are doing that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Like, I didn't know what a real estate developer was until less than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 32 years old.
Yeah,
I didn't know what a developer, like, you see all these buildings, you see stuff going up. I never thought about who built it. I just thought it was, I don't know, some rich people or some big company. But I'd never even imagined that I could be sitting talking to you, someone mm-hmm. who's like about to build 900 units. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a story for so many people.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. I think it's something we need to normalize.
Like,
you know, it is attainable.
Yep.
Because, you know, there are folks who look like us and come from similar backgrounds who are doing things all across the board within real estate. So I definitely second that.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. So one thing I saw when I was doing some research is that y'all have done some condo conversions.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had anybody on the show who's done a condo conversion, at least that I'm aware of. Can you talk a bit more about that and what went into deciding to convert it to a condo rather than another exit?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story. So back to the letter campaigns, right, is we were sending out letters to zip codes that we wanted to be in. And we sent a letter out and the lady called us back and she said, you know, hey, you know, I know you want to buy my property in Tremé, but I don't want to sell this, but I got this property in the French Quarter that you should come and take a look at. And I honestly, I was like, this lady's African-American. There's no Black people that own property in the French Quarter. She may think she in the French Quarter, but she's not, right? Because that's, you know, people can say they're property in the French Quarter, but they're not. And so she said, well, just meet me at the property, you know, and we met her at a property. And for sure, she had a property two blocks off of Bourbon Street. Wow. It was in terrible condition. And, you know, it had been abandoned since Katrina. It had been passed down multiple generations with her grandmother and grandfather being one of the first, you know, African-American homeowners or owners of properties, you know, in the French Quarter. And, you know, we established a relationship, right? She had some high asking price that she wanted. And finally, we kind of got to realistic terms. And then we, you know, we got to a selling price. And then we had to let her know, like, hey, we really ain't got the money to do this deal, right? Could you finance it for us? Could you serve as the bank and let us go raise some private capital, do the renovations, and then we'll sell it? And so after a couple months, she finally said, hey, look, you know, I've got this higher offer, but I see something in y'all and I want to support y'all and I'm going to finance the deal. You don't have to pay me any payments until 12 months and wow. Y'all just go do the, you know, find the money, do the renovations. And we end up converting that building into luxury condos, two luxury condos. And it was a whole experience dealing with the historical commission and renovations. And basically we just went all in. Everything we had, we threw into that property and we ended up selling it for the highest, the most, it became the most expensive condo sold in the French Quarter at that time. And it was a great success story. And then we found another building that was bigger and we did the same thing. And that was really kind of our transition from small multifamily properties, because now we had these dollars that we could 1031 exchange into a large apartment building, right? And yeah, it was definitely a heavy lift, and we always go back to those times. But Miss Sandra, she was so instrumental. You know, I talk about those relationships, you know, and where the gaps are. We benefited from that gap on the other side because she looked at somebody that looked like her son and or her nephew and said, "Hey, I want to help that person out," and we definitely benefited from that.
That's amazing, man. Yeah. You mentioned the historical, dealing with the historical district folks. What was that experience like? Were they very difficult about certain modifications? Like, how does that typically work?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that's probably one of the most protected districts. I mean, you have, you know, in New Orleans, we have the Historic District Landmark Commission, which, you know, takes over a lot of our city, right? You know, a lot of our city is historic. And so they make sure that the exterior colors and the type of wood that you use and the type of windows and everything that they can see from the street is approved. Well, the French Quarter has this whole other body on top of that, which basically is preserving everything around the building and even some of the interior things. And so, you know, us being our first foray into this, we made a lot of mistakes, right? We started changing out windows and they like, hold up, purple sign on the door, like, you can't do this. You got to come in this meeting and tell us why you did this. And, you know, it was a learning experience for us to start to deal with some of those political things. Yeah. Full circle though, one of our business partners, he's on the board of the Vucaré. And
go.
So, you know, it is a full circle moment, but that was very difficult for two, you know, 25-year-old guys and Black dudes in the French Quarter trying to do luxury real estate was definitely a heavy lift.
Definitely, man. That's incredible. So we talked about it a little bit throughout the interview, but a big problem is access to capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so how have y'all been able to raise capital, and you know, now you're to the point where you're at the institutional level. So you mentioned Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
How's it been like for you, and what tips do you have for someone out there who's looking to do similar things, but the raising capital part has been challenging? Maybe they're scared, or maybe they just keep getting a lot of rejections.
Yeah, I mean, look, the rejection is a part of it. When you start asking people for money, you know, you're probably going to be at best, you know, when you're first starting out, 70%, right? So I got 10 times as many banks and investors that have told me no than have told yes. So I think you kind of got to get comfortable with the no's, but you also got to learn the language, right? And that takes time, experience, and being willing to get, you know, to take your shots, right? You got to get reps. So, you know, I may go into this meeting, I may bomb, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back and say, hey, what could I have done differently? Like, what were you really like listening for? Why didn't I get that deal? And most of the time, they would give you some feedback like, hey, look, we need to see more experience, or maybe you need to bring a partner in on a deal, or hey, we really didn't get a clear vision on how you're going to cover debt service or how are you going to return equity. And so you kind of take those building blocks and those learning lessons and get around those folks, right? And so a lot of times what I would do is when I would go to these network events, I would go hang with the bankers and I would say nothing, right? I would just sit there with my little drink and I would listen to them talk and hear them talk about what their pain points are and what they wanted to see in a deal and why this deal wasn't good. And I'm just kind of like downloading all the information. So when I'm putting my professional presentation together, right? So that's another point, is you don't walk into a meeting and ask for money without a professional presentation, right? So when I'm putting that together, I've got all that data, and that just kind of stacks up, right? Because now friends and family, they want a certain type of information and what that looks like. You kind of hit that mode. Same with local banks. Then when you get to institutional, like, you know, it's like all Madden, right? So now you got to make sure that you come correct and learn that those different levels of lingo and what they want to see as well too. So it's as much about trial and error as it is, you know, being able to download information and ultimately show folks, you know, what they want and be able to communicate that clearly.
For sure, for sure. For those who may not be familiar with like the terminology, how would you define like an institutional investor?
Yeah, so institutional would be, you know, folks that are like your Goldman Sachs, your Blackstones, folks who are not on a local level and all they do is invest, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're looking for investment opportunities. They're not necessarily, depository banks, right? Where these are funds that are pooled together and really at the highest level of sophistication over a global perspective, right? So that's they what they do is invest. They don't give out house loans. They don't give out car loans per se. They are truly investment, you know, investment driven.
Appreciate that. And there's one thing you mentioned that I think is great, and I think people really should pay attention to, is that after all of the rejections, you're getting feedback.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's very easy for us to lean into our pride and, you know, be upset. And those are valid emotions, but it's a missed opportunity to not ask for feedback.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that you did that.
Now, don't get it twisted. Now, I was like Ricky in the in Boys in the Hood, you know, when I went home and they told me no, right?
Yeah.
But you know, it once you calm down, you realize, okay, I got to be able to grab value off of this, right? And be able to grasp something from this loss, per se, quote unquote. Because typically, a lot of those folks that told us no early on, they go, oh, that was y'all that did that deal over here? Well, maybe we should talk again. Mm-hmm. And now you built that experience, you understand what they want, and use their own feedback to be able to drive dollars.
Definitely. I love it. So what's it been like for you guys the last year or so, just with the increase in cost of materials, interest rates? Has that changed anything for y'all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's much harder now than, let's say, 2 years ago to get deals done. Mm-hmm. I think we have always stuck to a very conservative underwriting, right? So we're not the type of firm where we pull capital, we get money in, and now we got to figure out how we go and spend it. We do every deal by deal. We do an individual raise, and we're very specific about the criteria that we want to see, and we're cash flow driven, right? Mm-hmm. And so, that has become much more difficult as insurance rates increase. as construction costs increase, as insurance rates double and triple in our region, it's become, you know, much more difficult. We've still been able to get deals done, but we got to be very choose wisely in where we go.
Yeah. You say double, triple insurance?
Oh, yeah. That's not uncommon here to on a renewal to see. I mean, it's the worst insurance market that I've seen. I haven't been in the game, you know, that long, but it's not uncommon, you know, to get your insurance renewal and it's doubled, and then, you know, get the next one, it's doubled again.
Wow. So I'd imagine, like, at the outset of stuff, y'all probably being super conservative with your numbers just to account for those jumps.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. I mean, you got to be able to project what that looks like. Yeah. And, you know, sellers are dealing with, you know, serious NOI issues that they bought in, let's say, 21, 22, when insurance were a third of where they were and interest rates were a third of where they or half of where they're at. So if you're thinking about trying to refinance, you know, 2 or 3 years later, you know, there's going to be some properties, some REO opportunities that are going to be out there. And so I think it's been up to us to be patient and make sure that we're not getting into any bad deals.
Wow. What do you think has made the insurance like jump so much in the last year or so?
I mean, you know, if you look at the way insurance companies kind of base, you know, thing is they typically plan on, you know, a major catastrophic hurricane in kind of the Southeast region every 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. So typically that's kind of how they've done their risk analysis, is every 5 years we have one of these huge events.
Yeah.
Well, since 2018, we've had one every year. Right. And so they've never had the opportunity to recoup and base those profits. Right. And this is not only just on in New Orleans. A lot of these carriers are in Houston or in Texas or in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. And so we might not have got a huge hurricane last year, but, you know, Hurricane Harvey, I think, was in Texas at one point in time. And then you had Michael come through Florida. So all of these insurance companies are sucking wind and ultimately pulling out of these markets, leaving less competition, and, you know, the folks who are still there are just charging erroneous prices.
Definitely. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly something for people to keep in mind.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because no one talks about insurance. And I think insurance is just one of those things that's, quite frankly, just confusing.
Yeah.
So I think even just what you shared about the risk analysis, I mean, that's a great starting point.
Yeah.
Even, it's something that's even been confusing to me. It's like, well, how does all this stuff really work?
So yeah,
that breakdown was helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had something a little similar here in Katrina in 2005. And, you know, there's got to be some help, right? Because, you know, they're looking at their balance sheet and they got to figure out how to be profitable. And ultimately, we've got to have it, right? Yeah. And, you know, you got to figure out, the market resets itself, right? Is now, you know, you got to underwrite a property at $2,000 a door as opposed to $600 a door on insurance. And so the prices has to adjust to here, right? And there's a reset of the market. I don't think that's happened yet, but it has to happen in order for deals to happen.
Definitely. So what does the future look like for VPG? You know, it's been amazing what y'all been able to accomplish over the last 10 plus years and the River District project, a lot of exciting stuff. Anything else that you're looking forward to in the next several years or so?
I mean, I think for us, it's just sustained growth. I mean, we've been in hyper growth mode for the last, you know, 13 years. And I think for us is making sure that we protect our current investments, right? Be smart about where we go in the future and look for those opportunities that really feed into our investment criteria, right? Decrease our risk profile a little bit, but also look for those special opportunities where our expertise and, you know, our track record, you know, plug in. I think we're going to continue in a new construction development model, but also look at how we do public-private partnerships, right? Mm-hmm. And leverage some of our relationships, you know, there as well, too. So we're in New Orleans now. We definitely would like to be expanding geographically to de-risk our geographical presence, you know, obviously, you know, here in New Orleans with the weather. But you know, we want to keep growing. Our goal is $1 billion. You know, we're not there yet, but that's ultimately the goal for VPG.
We're gonna do part two. When you hit that half a million, then 750, then billion. Yeah. We gotta get those progress updates,
for sure,
man.
For sure.
So what advice do you have for someone who is just like you and your business partner was 13 years ago? You know, they're starting with that single family, that duplex, triplex, four unit, whatever it is, and they have the visions to do what y'all are doing now. Like, what advice do you have for someone in that position that you wish you had?
Oh man, I think it's always just know your numbers, right? It's make the decision off of what's in front of you, right? And you know, real estate can be an emotional experience, especially when you're buying your house and you're living there. But when you come to investing, you got to kind of pull your emotions and your sometimes that gut out of the deal. Sometimes it's good to get experience and kind of feel your way through, but you know, you got to make your decisions based on, you know, what's on paper. And it also is not be afraid to partner. You know, we've been able to grow our business and not all partnerships have been great, right? I'm not going to say everyone turns out rosy, but that is how you leverage and you become compatible with something that somebody else doesn't have, right? And once you're able to do that, you build experience. You may not need that person on the next deal. And then you may need to level up your partner on the next one as well, too, as you trade up. So I think just keeping your eyes open and understanding that real estate is not a game or a business that you build by yourself. You got to have partners. You got to have strategic folks on your team to be able to take it to the next level.
Definitely. Love that. Love that. So, man, before we wrap, where can people keep up with you? Reach out if they want to connect. What would be the best way to keep up to date with what VPG has going on and what you have going on?
Man, I'm terrible with social media, but I am on LinkedIn. So, you know, Michael Meredith, I definitely can respond there. At VPG Construction is our most active social media page where you can kind of keep up with all things VPG. Yeah, my email address, mmeredith, MERIDETH at VERIUSproperty.com.
Love it, man. I definitely appreciate you taking some time to join the interview live from New Orleans. It's amazing to be back. Love this city. And, you know, your story is inspiring, you know, and I think it's something that can be replicated. If
Absolutely.
Folks have the staying power, you know, continue to fight, don't give up, continue to learn, and you never know what could happen. So I appreciate you being transparent and sharing your story, man.
Absolutely.
Definitely. And thank you to everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, share, subscribe. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.